Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
It's not often you get to speak to somebody, is it, who's been in the profession for so long and got that kind of lineage of exactly how things have moved on and changed from a behind-the-scenes point of view.
I must admit, it's funny, isn't it? When you think about it, we've known her for, it must be 15, 16 years or something.
Yeah.
But it's sort of, we see her and bump into her. We've had some really interesting times with her and her husband, Rhys.
Yeah,
just really nice people. But the background to her getting there, I thought was fascinating.
Yeah. But also that kind of whole sense of saying yes to things and then what it leads to because you just never know. But I was also interested in her predictions for the future. I'm sure the listeners will find that interesting too.
Yeah, to see how they correlate to their own.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Well, thank you for joining us. If this is your first episode, you're very welcome. And if you'd like to subscribe for future episodes, then please feel free to do so. Yet again, it's exciting guest time.
Another podcast with another great guest that we have known for a good long time.
And I'm so looking forward to it. So today, we are very fortunate. We have Susie Rowlands joining us. And Susie is the executive administrator for the British Association of Cosmetic Dentistry, the BACD, but also the BAPD, the BADT, but more importantly, a positive force in dentistry.
Yeah, definitely.
Welcome, Susie. How are you?
Hello.
Hello, chaps. I'm fine, thank you. Nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. As you said that, it's hard to think. I think it probably must be coming up for close on 20 years.
It's the 20th conference next year. And so we missed in 2020 because of COVID.
As we all did.
Where was the first one, Susie?
The first one was November 2004, which was in London. And part of the reason that they are in November is because I started in February 2005 because I was in a job that I gave my notice in, but I had a prior commitment at the same time as the conference that I couldn't get out of. It was a thing at the Chilean embassy. And I couldn't not do it. I didn't want to be hauled across and dragged into exile somewhere. So I had to do this event. But they got it together quite quickly. And they did it in, it was the Selfridges Hotel. You know where that, you know what I mean? It's not there anymore. It's the one that's as your side entrance. But it was in the Selfridges Hotel, and apparently it was absolutely amazing, but I couldn't go. So they had speakers, the AACD, the American Academy, helped enormously and sent a lot of speakers over. And then it just took off from there, basically.
Wow.
Brilliant.
It was November because you weren't available?
It was November because that was the earliest they could manage to get everything together. And it's as good a month as any, isn't it? I mean, you know what it's like. June is always a nightmare for meetings. September's kind of too close to coming back after the school year.
Yeah.
And then there's so many other things going on across the year that you might as well stick with what you know.
And I suppose you'd have avoided, wouldn't the old BDTA showcase was October.
Yes.
That was October, wasn't it?
But it's a nice run up for the party season, isn't it? Because you always like to have a little party at the end of conference.
Avoiding, Thanksgiving, if you've got US speakers as well.
Yes.
And there are so many variables, aren't there?
Yeah, brilliant.
There are. But before we get to your dental career, let's roll back and try and dig into who Susie Rowlands is. So take us back into your childhood and give us a sense of understanding why you become so successful. What was your childhood like? Yeah.
Oh,
where
lovely.
Was that? Where were you brought up?
I was brought up in a place called Hadnall, which is north of Shrewsbury, and lived in the same place my whole life. My mother was, I'm adopted, you know, that's not a big secret. Mm. I know some people are paranoid about not finding out, but I was always told from an early age, to the point where I was told that I was chosen and everyone else, you know, got stuck with their children or their parents, until one day at school, my father, after he walked down to get me from primary school, and he said, he always called me Cariad, which is, he was Welsh, and he said, which means darling, he said, you've been telling everyone that you're much better than them, haven't you? That you're a little princess. He said, now we all know that you are, but you can't keep saying it all the time at school, so you have to stop. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I didn't know I had an extraordinarily happy childhood. You know what that was like. I'm 60, I'm 61 this year. And it was different. I would, walk down the road to school and I would be collected usually on the way back. My mother came from a big farming family, so she was brought up nearby. My father, he was the youngest of three brothers, and his oldest brother, my Uncle David, was the vicar in Hadnall. Uh-huh. And when my father came back from the war, both his parents had died fairly young. His father, he was born on Anglesey, and his father was a judge, but they both died in their early 50s of heart attacks, I think. And so he had nowhere to go when he came back, he had nowhere to live. He had no family, nothing, no home. So he moved to live with his brother, and then he met my mother, and that was that. But no, I had an extraordinarily happy childhood. And when I did, I know people look back with, rose-tinted glasses, but I did. I was a happy child. I had lots of love and affection, big family around. My mother was the youngest. She had four older brothers. So she was very spoiled. My mother, there was a big age gap in my mother's family. So she was the youngest. Her oldest brother was 18 years older than her. So she was at prep school with her nephew. I have a photograph of her when her older brother got married in the 1920s, and she's dressed like a little tiny flapper as a bridesmaid with a little, with a little hat on, a little fringe dress. Yeah,
flip.
Yeah.
So, did you have any siblings, or were you an only child, or whatever?
No, I have a younger brother, so he's 3 years younger than me, Richard, and he was adopted as well. So he lives locally. He lives south Shropshire in a place called Montford Bridge, which is just outside Shrewsbury. So.
Right, yeah, which is still, you're still in that neck of the woods, aren't you?
Yes, we are. So I moved to London after university, but then my husband is from Shropshire as well, and we had always intended to move back, and we did. Right. So we moved back in May 2018, and it's fantastic. We love it.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I know that you were charting your renovation of your house online.
Oh, yes.
It's fascinating to see all the work you haven't done.
Yes, you'll be amazed to know that there's still some snagging to be done, Steve the Builder.
Yeah. Isn't there always?
There's always snagging, isn't there?
Yeah. So you finish your schooling,
yes.
And then what was there an intervening period between then and you then having your first foray into the world of dentistry?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I moved to London after university, and my father said to me, if you can type, you'll always have a job. He said, you might not use it, but he said, if you can type, and he could type, he was a pharmacist. Right. So I've no idea where or when he learned to type, but he could. And I started off working as a temp, and I worked in quite a few law firms. And one of them was, I mean, I had various, bits and pieces of temping jobs, which you do.
What was your degree in, Susie?
Business studies, which is a vague title, but it just means that it's a sort of like an admin type degree, which has come in handy, but they didn't teach you how to type. But certainly being a law secretary, if you go into working as a legal secretary, you learn to type extraordinarily fast. Mm. So I worked primarily in IP, intellectual property litigation. And I ended up at a firm on the Aldwych called Baker & McKenzie, who at the time, remember this was in the 80s, at the time they were the biggest law firm in the world. They were based in Chicago, but the office in London wasn't huge. I think it's done one of those big mergers now, but they had an office on the Aldwych, which was marvellous, just behind Covent Garden.
Yeah, lovely.
I ended up in there as a temp, and then they kept me on to cover. They kept me on as a floating temp, so I floated from department to department.
Right.
And then I ended up in the IP litigation department. So we did trademarking mostly for companies like Chupa Chups, those lollipops, Louis Vuitton. Watches of Switzerland. I can spot a fake handbag and a fake watch still from my It's a good education. We had a safe full of actual real watches. You know, you name a watch, we had a real one in there. So, yeah. But that's where I kind of learned to think on my feet, because you'd often have council phoning you in a massive panic one morning saying, I'm going to court in half an hour. And they'd hurl all this stuff down the phone at you, or they'd courier around, you know, a little cassette tape, which you then have to transcribe. Yeah. And you could not make any errors. You absolutely could not make any errors at all. So I can still type at about 100 words a minute with no mistakes.
A great transferable skill as well.
Oh, massively.
So was the draw for a girl from Shropshire to come to the bright lights of London? Was that the excitement of getting drawn into the big city?
Everybody moved. They just did. You know, all my school friends did. I mean, we had I went to a private day school in Shrewsbury High School for Girls. And we had, my year, it was 30, there were two classes. There were 30 in each class. And that sounds small, 60 in a year. But for us, that was quite a big year. That was the biggest intake they'd had. And most of us moved away. Most of us went to London because you were expected to go to university. You didn't not go to university. You know, you stayed on. A few people, I think, out of our whole year, I think possibly six people stayed on to do Oxbridge, which you did then. You did an extra term.
Yeah.
So you would have done, you know, you stayed on. So you had the upper, the middle, you had the lower, the middle, and the upper six. So you had the upper six was the year when everyone's, if you stayed on. Yeah. But most of us left and went off to do, you know, various things. And I partly moved down to London because I wanted to do this postgrad typing thing anyway. And that was the best place to do it. And of course you got student grants in those days, and you could get, you know, you could get grants, couldn't you? You could get grants to just keep going.
You forget about that, don't you? You could do all sorts of stuff.
And they would pay you. And because my father was by then retired, I got a full grant. So I was quite happy about that. Brilliant. As was he.
I'm sure there's lots of people listening to this thinking, you were paid to learn?
What's a grant?
Yes,
you were given money to learn.
And it was in those days, you didn't need a degree, but it was much better to have one, wasn't it?
Where did
you live when you came down?
I started off living just over Hammersmith Bridge in Castlenau. So I hadn't found anywhere to live. And my mother came down with me to sort of make sure that I was, you know, I had to come and do the exam to get in. And then I had to come and fill in millions of forms. And there was a lady in the office called Alison who took in lodgers. And so my mother said, oh, why don't you stay? So I did. And it was lovely. So you go over Hammersmith Bridge. I know you can't anymore, but it was on the left. There's a big Castlenau Mansions, huge set of mansion blocks. And she lived there. And she took in lodgers, just one lodger. Her husband worked on oil rigs, so he was away quite a lot. And she had a lovely little boy called Jack, so I could, you know, babysit him. And it was nice. So I like that side of London, so I could just walk in over the bridge. And, you know,
that's
it's nice.
Easily commutable, isn't it?
It's easily commutable, isn't it? Although now I think Hammersmith Bridge is closed, isn't it, to traffic anyway?
Yeah.
Because it was always quite fragile. Even
that's
then,
right, it might fall down.
Yeah.
So they can't do much about. They have to close it to fix it, don't they?
Yeah.
So then to jump forward, I know that in 1995 you worked at the FDI, the World Dental Federation. Yes. So what was the kind of the segue from doing IP for Chubba Chups and Louis Vuitton?
So in between
to then ended up in dentistry.
After I stopped doing. Law. So what happened was my boss at the time, the partner I worked for, he was headhunted by a firm called Herbert Smith.
The
time, they were known at the time as very aggressive litigators. And the thing to do then was you usually took your secretary, you took your assistant with you. It was part of the deal. That wasn't at all uncommon. So James and I moved to Herbert Smith and we absolutely hated it. They were just all about the money. I'm not saying that Baker and McKenzie were, but they were very aggressive and they were very, I don't know, it just wasn't wasn't an unpleasant place to work, but it just didn't have the friendly atmosphere of Baker and McKenzie. Yeah. So James ended up going back to Yorkshire, which is where he was originally from, and he set up on his own. I lost touch with him. And I was scouting through the creme de la creme looking for jobs. And I saw this one advertised saying small publishing firm. I don't even think it said dental. Anyway, off I went to the interview in Soho, and it was the FDI. And then I still wasn't entirely sure what I was supposed to be, you know, doing. So they interviewed me, and then they phoned me about a week later and offered me the job. So in I went, and I started on the 1st of June, 1995. And it was still a complete mystery to me how everything worked
until brilliant.
The conference. So the first conference was September that year in Hong Kong, because one of the things they said to me at the interview was, the way they phrased it, they said, oh, you'll have to go to Hong Kong in September. And I said, oh, okay. You
know, what a shame, yeah.
Terrible. So off I trotted. And until you see, it's like trying to explain, because they have two separate parts. They have the scientific part, you know, like the BACD does. And then they also have the council meetings and all the committee meetings and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was in that area to start with. So I was the executive director had two assistants, myself and a lady called Margaret, who I'm still in touch with. She long ago retired. And we did that part. But you're literally chucked in at the deep end. You really are.
Wow.
Until you see a conference in action, it's difficult to explain it to somebody. You can look at it all you like on paper. You know, until you see, it's like when we have the students coming to our events. They don't quite know what to expect, do they? And for us, all three of us, we know exactly what happens at a dental show, don't we? Or at a show or a meeting. But to someone who's never been to an event, they have no idea. So it's a whole different thing. But once you're there, it was great. I loved it there because it was quite a small, I mean, there weren't that many staff. I think there were about 20 of us. But with those large, huge meetings, I mean, you know, tens of thousands of meetings, they're booked years in advance, 5 or 6 years in advance, and you have an on-the-ground team.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So following Hong Kong, that job also took you to France, where you stayed for a period of time?
Yes. Yeah, so what happened was the lease on the office, we were in an office in Soho next to Private Eye. It was marvellous. They would pop in mid-afternoon to collect their post, then lurch off to wherever they lurched off to. They were very friendly. But it was a tall, thin building, and we were growing out of it, and the lease was running out. Now, there will never be an FDI, World Dental Federation, conference in the UK. There's nowhere near big enough. You know, I did a conference in Orlando for 60,000 dentists. So,
oh, my goodness.
Which was great. Yeah, it's marvellous.
Wow,
that's amazing, isn't it? I mean,
a lot of dentists.
It's a huge amount of dentists.
So, but their average size is probably 15 to 20,000. So there's nowhere anywhere near large enough. So they started casting about, and I can remember. So my boss was this lovely, lovely Swedish dentist called Peroka Zelaine. And we went to look at Centrepoint, and that was marvellous going up there. We went right up to the top, and you could look down and see all the roof. There's so many people have roof gardens that you obviously can't see unless you're right up at the top, can you? So we looked and we looked, and then we thought, well, we don't need to be in the UK. Anyway, this all panned out to us moving to France. So they announced this, and I think it was certainly a way of culling the office, because by the time they'd finished, there were like three of us left, I think. So, and obviously, and I said, first of all, I said, well, I can't, you know, what's my husband going to do? Oh, we'll give him a job. So I spoke to him, and he said, oh, yes, I can go skiing at lunchtime. So that was, that was it. So they put him in charge. They put him in the Congress department.
It was easy to keep Reese happy.
He used to work in logistics. So he used to work for LEP a long time ago. So that's why he does, you know, that's why he does everything for the conference in terms of his exhibition, because he knows what to do. So off we went. But we were in a place called Ferney-Voltaire, which my husband described as the Huddersfield of France. Sorry to all those people who live in Huddersfield, but really it wasn't the prettiest place you've ever seen, fair to say. And it was right on the border with Switzerland. Literally, you could see, if you craned your head far enough, you could see the border. And where we lived, a little village, it was 95% non-French, because CERN was there and we were in the big loop.
Oh, okay. Right.
So in our block, there were all nuclear physicists. I'm not making
international scientists.
There were Russians, there were Japanese, there were Australians, there were Canadians, there were every nationality known to man. And what they really should have done was moved to Switzerland as an NGO, which they have done since. But it was fine. It was a big culture shock because living in France is completely different than visiting France, because it is closed most of the time, it's fair to say. And it's not, you're not in a sort of beautiful scenic area. Well, we were the Bas de Jura and we were about 40 minutes from the tunnel. So we could easily go, through and into Italy. And you'd often go into Geneva to get lunch because the food was better. The food was better. Okay. Your choice of sandwich was either ham, cheese and ham, ham and cheese. Very occasionally, you get tuna, or on a very rare occasion, you get salami. And that was it. So if you go to the airport, so we were really close to the airport. So you'd go through the border control. You'd go through the border controls all the time. You'd sometimes go accidentally if you weren't looking where you were going round and roundabout, because there were so many border controls where we live. But it was very, it was quite hard to find somewhere to live because obviously Switzerland is insanely expensive. So most people who work in Switzerland often live in France because it's cheaper.
Right. Yeah. Are you quite impulsive, Susie? You strike me as somebody who finds it quite easy to say yes to things based on how you've recounted your life so far.
I kind of am. But it was a bit sort of, my French was kind of like A-level French. And in fact, A-level French is not much different than O-level French. All you do is you study more complicated set texts. And, I did the same set text for French and for ancient Greek as well, which was a bit weird.
But you can't work in the pen of my auntie into many conversations.
Exactly.
Or the cat sat on the table or whatever. Yeah.
So it was, and also, we got by. My French was good enough to get by, both of us were, but everybody spoke extraordinarily good English. They just did. And but I just thought it would be stupid to say no. And I thought, what have I got to lose? We knew that we wouldn't stay there for probably longer than about 18 months, which we didn't. It was a learning experience. And it was interesting because we did lots and lots of driving around. My mother used to come and stay all the time because she loved it. Because you could easily, Switzerland is very, very beautiful. It is a really beautiful place. And Geneva, whilst being quite boring and super expensive, is very pretty around there.
The lake.
The lake, the Lac Le Mans. And it's just very pretty. And we were, as I said, we were close to the Jura. We were close to, we could easily go into Italy. It wasn't far at all to go into Italy. You go through the tunnel and pop out in Aosta on the other side. And it was just nice, So we did, while we were there.
I think I had my most expensive coffee once on a lake, on a hotel on Lake Geneva. Mm. It was like 25 quid or something for a cappuccino.
You can't go anywhere from Geneva apart from, say, Zurich or somewhere. Flying anywhere was a complete nightmare because you'd always have to go via somewhere. You could fly back to the UK. That was when I developed my absolute hatred of EasyJet, because at that time there weren't nearly so many flights from BA flights to Heathrow. So it was all, EasyJet always did Geneva to Gatwick. Mm. But I can remember going to Sydney and leaving Geneva at about 6 o'clock on a Friday, then getting to Frankfurt at about 11, then getting on a plane at Frankfurt and waking up in Singapore, sometime on Saturday evening, off the plane, walking around to try not to pass out from tiredness, back on the plane to Sydney, and then arriving in Sydney on Sunday morning, having lost two nights and a day. Oh, it was, it was no fun. It was no fun
at all. Horrendous.
Because you just can't go anywhere. You can go to Zurich, I suppose. That's about it.
Yeah. So we're easing ourselves towards the BACD, but we're not quite there yet because between the French experience and you started on the BACD, which is in 2005, you then helped set up a wine importing company, which is an interesting segue.
So I came back. So we came back after 18 months and I didn't want to do anything that was massively taxing. I tempt again, which is always a good way to find out what's going on. And then I was sent as a temp to work to see this. I was warned that, he gets three PAs at a horrible rate. And I thought, let's see about that. So he's an extraordinarily wealthy And then she said, I'm sending you because you won't take any, you know, shit from him. I said, I certainly won't. And so, and also, you know, I never had to worry about finding work. I knew I would be able to find work. Yeah. I wasn't ever thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to be on the breadline. I can't pay my mortgage, blah, blah, blah. Mm. So I went, and it was in Covent Garden in Wellington Street, actually, just by where the Lion King is. And he was a very wealthy, I mean, billionaire wealthy Israeli businessman. And his brother had invented some sort of valve that is used in our open heart surgery. Don't ask me what it is, but it's like a really, it's like a life-saving thing that his brother had inherited. And the brother lived in Israel, but my boss lived in, well, he moved when I was there, St. James's. You know, remember where WAC used to be at Reach Presenter? And like further on, those lovely houses that are looking onto the park. Well, that's where he lived. Yeah. Gorgeous. Wow. I went there a few times. But he was a really, really nice man. And I think no one had ever sort of, I don't know, people were just intimidated by him. I just thought he was just nice. He was just very friendly. Mm. Mm. He expected you to do a lot, but that was fine. And so what he wanted to do was set up a wine importing company. He poached all the best people, the buyers from M&S and Majestic and all those wine warehouses, and then just set up this wine importing company. And it was really, really good fun. And I learned so much about wine when I was there. It was brilliant, especially white wine. And I can find my way around a wine list now. You know, it's not that, you know what it's like, you go and you just buy stuff. You can never go wrong with a Chilean Merlot or an Argentinian Merlot. And you can, it was just fascinating. We had some really good like wine tasting things. And then you'd go, there's lots of things that go on all over the country, but especially in London. And there used to be a Wines of Chile thing. And that was fascinating because you'd go off to the ambassador would come around and he'd bring
what,
all the
What
wine.
I love about that story, Susie, is that that guy came with quite bad press. Don't go, he's always getting, and then you took the opportunity. And that's the thing. And so you had a true first-hand opinion as opposed to listening to what other people said. Because nobody else got on with him didn't mean that he was a bad person. Because you did.
Even the benefit of the doubt. That's what I've
always thought of you, Susie, as it's one of those people who never takes fools, you know, you're like,
I think he realised that, you know, I wasn't.
Yeah, always exuded that to me. But it's when I think of why we get on, really, because it's sort of that just fun sort of respect thing, isn't it? Of the fact of actually we're going to get a job done, but we're also going to have a bit of entertainment while
we're
doing it.
Absolutely. And he was good fun. I worked quite hard, but it was, you know, that was what you did then. And it was great. It's a great office to work in because I could walk to work from Waterloo over the bridge. And it was great fun in Covent Garden. So what more could you want?
Oh, lovely. Yeah, yeah.
And definitely. He was very nice. He wasn't, I was paid well. And then, BACD.
Nice wine cellar.
Yeah.
Very nice wine cellar. Very nice wine cellar.
I bet.
And we got given so much. Oh, we got given so much stuff. Oh, I'll take this taste. Because they would not just send one bottle. If you ask for something for a tasting, they send half a dozen bottles. So literally, you'd be clanking home and then clanking home on the train. I mean, I'm sure regular commuters must used to think, my God, that woman, what is wrong with
her?
She's
an alcoholic.
You know, she would have as much as you could possibly carry. And I'd be phoning Reese and saying, can you pick me up from the station? Again? Yes. I can't carry all home. I just can't.
Brilliant. So then in February 2005, we sort of come full circle to where we started at the beginning, which is you joined the BACD. And given that it had only just recently formed, and as the British Academy of Cosmetic Dentistry.
Yeah,
so that was quite a new concept, cosmetic, back in the early days when it was created.
I think it was.
You know, now, you know, cosmetics kind of a general term banded around dentistry quite commonly. Mm. But to think back in the early 2000s, it was quite a creative term.
And it was almost elite, wasn't it? It was that sort of like, oh, it's high end of private dentistry and lots of poshness and ridiculously expensive
It was. But then we were saying just before we started recording about the last Congress in Newport last year, yet how many young dentists now are involved. So whilst it's cosmetic and it inspires and aspires to people to get better and on the academy side, I think was it Frank Spear you had as your speaker? last year. You know, you're talking like world leaders. What is it that are kind of the magic ingredients that you've experienced and put together that have made it the community it is? Because you've been there pretty much since the beginning. How have you kind of built it in the way that it's come along?
I think the key word there is it's a community. I mean, you know what it's like. We know pretty much all of them. I'm the one constant because people come and go. And whilst people are on the board for a while, and when we first started, we discussed in the board then that it was important to have continuity. We couldn't, because what happens now is you're president for 1 year, because it is a big commitment. You know, you're on the board. And then you're vice president, you're president-elect, you're president, you're immediate past president. So that's like 5 or 6 years, which is a long time. And you have to think about the commitment before you decide you want to do this and think long and hard. So you're not paid for it. And whilst you can say, I am the president of the BACD, you can't use it to sort of, you know, make money off, or you can't. We have extraordinarily strict rules about, we always have had, you know, you can't use it for personal gain. And we felt it was important to have the same leadership in place for about, I think Chris was president for 4 years, possibly even five. But it was that, it built up from a family. And even now, 20 years later, I mean, I am seeing some people who obviously have retired who were older dentists when we started, but I'm still seeing people who have been members for a really, really long time, and they're always committed. And every year, so my key thing when I've put the conference up for booking, and it's sort of beginning of when it went up for booking, it's always up in time for the dentistry show because we can then advertise it. And there's two members who've been coming for years, and I live in fear. They will have to retire at some point. They must be my age. It's Jai Shah and Hanif Moti. When they booked, I know all is well with the world. As soon as they've booked, I put something in my board WhatsApp group, and I said, the boys have booked. Everything's okay this year.
They're your non-financial indicators.
I'd be happy.
It's and like the litmus strip going into we're okay.
It has changed for sure. You know, gone are the days where you have big, you know, we used to get 500 easily, 400 or 500 at a conference, and you don't anymore because you just don't. We're not that big an organisation. Yes, the ADI do, but there's lots more of them than there are of us. But we've maintained a fairly steady membership. Attendance has gone down, I would say, but I don't think that's a reflection on us. I think it's just a reflection on dentistry in general and conferences in general. And we always get quality rather than quantity because, you know, as exhibitors, that we tend to get the practice owners, and we get, you know, we have the spenders who come to our conference. And you also have people who really do want to expand their knowledge. And it's interesting, when I put the event up for booking, we had pre-booking in November. So we hadn't finalized day one with the hands-on sessions. We've got 8 this year again. One of them is the Young Dentist Stream. We had a vague idea of who was coming, but we just hadn't finalized it for all sorts of reasons. And we put it up for booking, and I think we got 65 people just booked, bang, without knowing, and all of them booked for all 3 days. They had no idea who was coming on the Thursday, and they weren't particularly bothered. They just booked.
But that's past that's past reputation, isn't it?
So people
know that in previous years it's been good. So whilst we don't know the names, you're not going to be putting up people who aren't going to be world class.
And we've got, we've got good speakers coming. But it's interesting, when you look at hands-on sessions, what you think will sell out straight away doesn't always. But ones that you think, I don't know, always just go quickly. It's very interesting. Yeah. You can never, ever predict it, though. It's impossible to predict.
It is. Absolutely. You think you know, don't you? We find it sometimes with practice sales, don't you? We look at the stuff the guys are putting into the market, and you think, oh, yeah, that'll fly. That'll fly. Oh, no, it hasn't.
No.
At all. And then there'll be another one where you think, I think that's going to be a bit tricky. Oh, hello. We've got 3 offers on it, and it's in the middle of Shropshire or something. Yeah. Who knew that Shropshire would become a hotbed of dental activity? Yeah. It's amazing. But I think it keeps us on our toes. I think that's a great thing.
But also, I think you, going back to that community thing, I think the events you put on as well outside of Congress, you know, the way that you you engage people and the way you promote yourself as well, because it's a fine balance, because it could look and feel a bit elitist, but it's not.
We are, as you know, we're absolutely not, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, people do think, oh, it's all cosmetic dentistry, it's all private, it's blah, blah, blah. And cosmetic dentistry is elective. Nobody's forcing you to have it.
Yeah.
And yet still people are, you know, going to have whatever they're having done. You know, there was this after lockdown, there was the Zoom boom, you know, people seeing themselves on a screen and going, yikes.
Yeah.
Give me that Botox.
But I also love the way that kind of the cosmetic strode aesthetic element carries through to where you host your events as well. I didn't come to Edinburgh, but I saw the footage of the Edinburgh event. I mean, what a spectacular venue. It was an incredible venue. And I know that, I think you're in London this year, aren't you?
So it was masterful in Edinburgh because it was the first one after lockdown, and everyone loves Edinburgh. Quite frankly, I'd have all my conferences there because the conference is so easy. They're so easy to deal with. It's not perfect, but nowhere's perfect. However, yeah, the National Museum of Scotland was just an inspired choice because, quite frankly, there are a lot of places to go. And also, that was the one that very nearly finished me off, because normally we would get around about, I don't know, 150, 160 at the gala dinner. This gala dinner just started going utterly bonkers. Coupled with the fact that having introduced the ability to book more than one ticket at a time, so if, say you booked and you wanted to bring, you can book as many as you want, and you thought, right, you know what, I know I'm going to book 10 myself plus 9 others. Yeah. But the total wasn't, so I downloaded the list and it was like 70 or something. I thought, that's not anywhere near enough, because I'd seen all the, you know, I have the bookings. And I added them all up. I thought, oh no, where are they going to go? What am I going to do with them all? Because it was, you know, it was like about 250. Panic attack, I realised that in fact you could seat 900 in there. So we would have been fine. But thank goodness we were. And then we suddenly went, and everybody who went to that is going to come again. And everyone didn't go to that is definitely going to come again, because we had 320 at that, which was unheard of, you know. But it's not like there isn't anywhere else to go in Edinburgh on a Friday night. There isn't, although there were some very weird COVID rules still in place that Nicola tried to push through, about you couldn't have at midnight, or like 1 minute past midnight, you had to either stop music or stop dancing or stop drinking. You could only have 2 out of 3. So I thought, I know. It's just this random thing. So she'd introduced this rule, which she'd been trying to push through for months and months and months, but everyone had resisted it. Wow. So in the end, we just took the music down to like lounge music.
So is a logic that COVID knew if you were drinking and listening to music, it would keep you safe. But if you were drinking and listening to music and started dancing, it would come for you.
Yeah,
because you're breathing
out. And also,
you were fine until
midnight, and then after that, it all went pear shaped. And apparently, the they were telling us that in nightclubs they were pushing a sofa out into the middle of the floor. Says no, it's a lounge area, it's a dance floor. What? No, nobody's dancing. It's a lounge area.
It's brilliant. People got very creative, didn't they?
Oh, very creative. So then last year we realised that, you know, we would have to up our game. So last year we got a company in to do it called Eventologists. So we had this theme, and it went really well. So this year, you just wait until you see it this year.
I'm sure most of the planning's already done.
It is, yes. Most of the planning's already done. We're just deciding on some features, shall we say. Some features.
And in a weird way, I think you might perhaps have benefited, because Edinburgh's a spectacular location. That was your first one post-COVID. Yes. Then you had Newport with the Red Dragon. Yes. So it might actually start to get at the core. Will be slightly bigger moving forward.
Yes, for
now.
Sure. Absolutely. And you get an awful lot of people going to the dinner who don't necessarily go to the actual conference, because people tell their friends about it. And quite frankly, I don't mind who go. You know, you're buying a ticket. You can't restrict people. Why would you do that?
Especially in London as well, because it's instantly... Definitely more accessible, isn't it?
It is more accessible. So, but I'm going to have to come up with something super spectacular for next year, because it's the 20th anniversary, and there's not, you know, There's not that many. There are places, but I don't want people, I don't want to have to, you know, bus people across town or something like that. Because a Friday night in London is pretty awful anyway, isn't it? So
Do you enjoy the challenge of every year needing to find something different or more creative or bigger or better or whatever?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
The bigger the better, if you ask me. Yeah. And it's trying to think of the only let's say I'm used to working when I came from the FDI, I was used to working a very long way in advance, like 5 or 6 years in advance. And I've had to, that's the only thing that there isn't that, there is a sense of urgency, but there isn't that huge sense of urgency. And whilst we don't have to work 5 years in advance here, we still have to, you know, we're booked to 27. So 25 will probably be Manchester, which I'm quite happy about. 26 will be back in London, and 27 will be Edinburgh, because we're already committed. Right. So, but at some point I have to retire, because, you know, I am quite old now.
Yeah, will they let you know? So that is the question.
The thing is, But you, well, I won't stand there, but can you, oh, Suze, if I stand for president, will you stay on? And I'm just like, I'll be 100.
And but you'll still be enjoying it. That's the thing, knowing you. Yeah.
And the thing is, it's not that you just do this for the BACD. You also offer executive admin to the BAPD, which is a fairly new organisation that kind of came out of COVID, particularly focused on private dentistry, and also the BADD. And I think one of the things that strikes me about dentistry is it's a very collaborative profession. You know, you're a shining example of the fact that you can step across different organisations and work with different groups, and people aren't operating in silos. And I think for you as an individual, it gives you a great sense and temperature of how the profession is. And how would you kind of characterise the profession at the moment?
I completely agree with you. The BADT, they are all delightful. It's got a good membership, and they are all absolutely lovely, all of them. They're great. A lot of them were treated appallingly during lockdown, particularly in NHS practices. We had anguished emails and phone calls from members who were not being paid. So all the practices were getting their money, which they're supposed to pass on to their staff, but in fact they weren't. They were holding on to it. People were saying, you know, I have to pay my mortgage. I've got to feed my children. So in the end, the GDC did set up the helpline to sort them out. And they had their conference last Saturday, Saturday before that. And in London, it was the 60th anniversary of them sort of being recognised. And it was brilliant. It wasn't a huge meeting. It was a one day meeting, but everybody who was there loved it. And it's interesting what you say about people can be apathetic about coming to meetings. And I think they have sometimes they've forgotten how much better it is to come to a meeting in person and to network. And it's whilst it is about the learning, it is also about meeting your peers and meeting other therapists. And there was a dinner in the evening, and there were a couple of girls on my table who said they hadn't been to anything before. They were quite young. And they said it was absolutely brilliant, and it would encourage them now to go to more in-person events to learn.
Well, that's lovely.
Built always that community, rely back to that word community
on distance learning, can you?
No, it's not
the same, is it?
And I think that's why fundamentally I'm not a massive fan of working from home. I think working from home works up to a certain point, but I think that sense of community, working with other people, you know, just building bonds and relationships, it's not as easy, and we are social creatures. So it's lovely to hear they came to the event and enjoyed it.
It's conversations they loved it. Isn't it? That's what they're brilliant.
And the BAPD, whilst they're not going to have sort of a conference because it's not that sort of organisation, I've picked up so much I didn't know, because really, you know, with the BACD, the vast majority are private dentists. They just are. Yeah. But the BAPD is a much bigger mix. And most of the people who set it up are former or current BACD members and some, you know, past presidents. So I knew most of them, but they're a delightful bunch. And I've met some really, really nice people through them. And, you know, they're doing quite well. They've done the theatres at the the showcase and at the dentistry show.
But what's interesting about that as well is that from the name, you assume all they're interested in is private dentistry to the exclusion of everything else. But I saw at the show, I was talking to Bertie and Simon, and they're like, no, we need to also understand NHS dentistry.
Definitely. Because
the reality is very few practices are purely one or the other. There's still a huge cohort that deliver mixed dentistry, and they've got a really sensible attitude to dentistry. And going back to that thing about it being collaborative, they've not just pigeonholed themselves. It's a smart move.
Inclusive, not exclusive.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. And as you say, there's a lot of practices who either were nudged by COVID or were thinking about it before going from, you know, NHS to private, and they haven't the faintest idea what to do. Just they have no idea. They have absolutely no idea. And so there's a lot of, you know, they're constantly doing webinars and stuff like that. We just updated the website. And then I've said to them, I think it would be a good idea to have something. And I'm mooting the idea of having it in October, but we'll see. It's just to have a little get together, just even if it's just for the board and all the committees and anyone else who wants to come, you know, just to have a bit of CPD and then do something else. Because it again, it's that meeting your peers in person, and it doesn't have to be in some. It doesn't have to be something super formal. I don't think that necessarily always works, does it? Not anymore. It doesn't.
No.
It just doesn't.
No.
I think those days are gone now, aren't they?
I think any event you go to, the most interesting conversations are with a glass of wine in the evening.
With a coffee, with a chat.
Yeah, that's where the kind of the really good stuff comes from.
Oh, absolutely. And it's we're doing, so we did the Porsche day, which
Oliver
came and filmed, which we were we were away, but it looked really amazing. We were in
He said it was a great day. Yeah.
But we've got the summer social coming up this year, which is at a brewery. So it's the Windsor and Eaton Brewery. You're very welcome to come. It's the Windsor and Eaton Brewery, which is owned by Millie Morrison, who's on one of our committees, two of our committees. Her father owns it. And so
that's convenient.
Talking about the finer details in January at the board and committee day. And I had what my husband referred to as the 100-year-old cough, which everybody seemed to have. You know, I'd been coughing since sometime in mid-December. I still haven't had COVID. It wasn't that. However, I wasn't feeling brilliant. So we went to the sort of social bit we'd done afterwards. And then I got back to the hotel room and I phoned Reese and I said, oh, we're doing this social event in August. So block the dates because we'll come down for it in Windsor. And I said, it's Millie Morris. I said, you know Millie Morrison, who's lovely. I said, you know, her father owns the brewery and we're doing this, this and this. And he said to me, oh, is she married? I said, no, darling, but you are. So go there, shall we? So, yes. So Reece said, you must make it really, really good because otherwise everyone's going to do the you can't organise a piss up in a brewery thing. But it's gonna so it's going to run from 4 o'clock in the afternoon and then there'll be and there'll be some education. There'll be an hour of education.
There'll be some food,
barbecue, all sorts of lovely barbecue food.
And, it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's going to be brilliant. And there's going to be some BACD beer as well. It's going to be really cool.
Brilliant.
So it's going to be very good. Yes, we had quite a lot of
people. Susie, as somebody who's so incredibly well placed in the profession, what are your predictions for the future dentistry? Where do you see it heading?
Dentistry. Don't let me say. Well, the GDC needs to sort itself out. It is just shocking. I mean, I don't even know where to start with them. Could they be more unhelpful? No, I don't think they could. Could they?
No,
they just couldn't. It's every single time they come out, I get, and there's a lot of this in my BAPD WhatsApp group, you know, as soon as some idiotic announcement comes up. But you couldn't make some of it up. You just couldn't. Do they really hate dentists that much? They appear to, don't they?
The GDC, I mean, we had that. Do you remember that was that article? I think we were talking to someone about it. You know, when they did that full-page advert about, do you want to sue your dentist? Effectively what it was saying. It's who does that?
No, go ahead. Who does that? Don't worry about the dentist. That's absolutely fine.
They're absolutely madness.
And I think, the NHS dentistry is in a shocking state. However... Yeah. People have to take more responsibility for their own dental health. I had a lovely dentist as a child. He was a really nice man and I never used to mind going. And I carried on coming back home to the dentist until I was in my early 30s, mostly because my mother would pay. And mostly because So I've got a crown on my front central. When I was about, I must have been at primary school. So I was about, my tooth wouldn't grow down. It kind of got halfway and it stuck. So I went to the dentist and he gave me this revolting injection and it came down, you know, almost straight away. And then I was roller skating. I can still remember this. It was a very long time ago. It was like 50 years ago. And I was roller skating across the playground at the primary school. And we were little children and we were on a big row, you know, holding hands. All of us were going. I was somewhere in the middle. And there was a drain.
Oh.
Yeah. So I went flying over it and flew face forward and chipped my tooth. And, you know, there was a lot of blood everywhere and it chipped it. But my mother was furious because it only just came down. So she was furious. So off I trotted to go and see the dentist, who was right opposite my school, the school I ended up at, Shrewsbury High School. So off I trotted, he just put composite on it. And then it stayed there till I was 18. And then I had a crown. And it was fine. And then my crown stayed on until I was in my early 30s. And then I went to a local dentist because I knew I would have to, you know, come up and down all the time
and to pay for it.
I have to pay for it and have it done. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. And my mother would have paid for it. But never mind. And I was, it was sorted out and that was that. And then after that, the main reason I was involved with the BAC was because of Chris Orr. So he was my dentist. So I met him in Hong Kong in 1995. He was on a committee and he was still a student because he's 10 years younger than I am. So he was still a student and we met and he became my dentist. I was very lucky that he turned into Dr. Orr, you know, the best dentist. So he then graduated and he was working in Soho. So he was working just around the corner from me for Oasis. So he was, he's not even 5 minutes walk from my office. And then that was that. And I was quite lucky, you know, he could have been a terrible dentist and I would have still been stuck with him, you know. So he said, do you want to be my patient? I said, yes. And he's very good. So that's partly how, you know, I knew him because he sat on some of my student committees at the FDI. And when we kept in touch, and then he turned into, you know, best dentist.
But I think you're right about that, taking responsibility for your dental health. I think there's a lot of people out there that, as in, you know, the population, who could easily transition themselves over into the private dentistry world,
of course,
but
they
for whatever reason don't, which would then free up huge capacity for the people that do need it. Because I think we'd all love to still see an NHS component for dentistry.
Yes, of course.
It'd be a real shame if it wasn't available, but it needs to work. At the moment, it's not working.
And you get people who, you know, you see this a lot with the therapists who say that they seem to think that we can perform miracles. But if you haven't been to your dentist, I mean, I always came back to go to the dentist. You know, I always saw the hygienist every 6 months and the dentist for a checkup once a year. Partly because, and it's not like, I mean, in my childhood, it was drill and fill because they were paid
for
filling, weren't they? Probably the same as you.
Yeah.
And Chris has replaced all my fillings with white composite. But he said, you know, these have lasted. Don't knock amalgam because these fillings have lasted for 30 odd years, 40 years,
right,
and they're perfectly okay. He said they're not going to fail anytime soon. So, you know, don't knock it. And yes, not everyone can afford to pay for cosmetic dentistry. However, I'll never forget, this is a few years ago, listening to a radio program. We were in the car going somewhere or other, and we had the radio on because there were traffic queues up ahead. And then they were interviewing some chap, and the radio interview was, he was moaning about, I can't go to the dentist and I've got toothache and blah, blah, blah. And, it's going to cost this much. And it wasn't very much. So the interviewer said, could you mind if I just ask you, have you been on holiday this year? He said, yes, we've been away twice and we're going to a villa in the blah, blah, blah the rest of this year. And I said, okay. And he said, car? He said, yes, my wife and I have both had new cars. And yet he wouldn't spend 200 quid. Yeah. On going to the dentist. And the interviewer said, I'm not quite sure what to say to you, but clearly you don't. I think he was expecting an easy ride. And they had people phoning in saying, what an idiot. You know, Nobody like wants to have to pay, but sometimes just suck it up. And you get one set of teeth. Why do people not realise this?
One set of teeth.
You're not going to get any others.
I always remember there was a dentist, some professor, and he said if people really understood that if you had to replace each tooth, he said, you know, let's just say £2,000 an implant. He said £64,000. He said, I bet you someone with a £64,000 car would service it, wash it, make sure it was looked after.
Yeah,
he
said, would.
Somehow, we need to turn what we give them with into people seeing not just the health benefit,
yes,
but almost the financial benefit of looking after them. It's nuts. Well,
because
isn't it?
If you don't, it's the thing that prevention is better than cure. You know, yes. I clean my teeth twice a day. I floss. You know, I do all the things you're supposed to do. And I always have done. It's just purely coincidental that, you know, I've ended up where I've ended up because I've always been good about going to the dentist. I had a nice dentist as a child. He was a lovely, lovely man. He had to retire early. He had some heart condition. So he was probably only in his 50s when he retired. And then he was replaced by another absolutely delightful dentist who lived just down the road from my mother. And, you know, it wasn't until I had to get this sorted out that I stopped going there, and they were just lovely. It was really nice.
Going back to your GDC thing, they probably should be doing an advert campaign that says you service your car once a year, why not service your mouth? In that sort of thing of bringing it to people.
It is. You only have to go. I don't go more than once a year. I don't need to. And if I had a problem, of course, I mean, I go to see James Russell now, who luckily for all of us has moved back to Shropshire. He moved back before we did, because otherwise I think I'd probably go back down to see Chris. But I do see James, so we're lucky that we've got someone, you know, who is as good here. And I try and send all my friends to him. But I do. I mean, I go regularly because why wouldn't you?
Yeah, science madness. It's just absolutely madness.
I can't understand the rationale between, you know, long before I ever came near any jobs that involved dentistry, I always went to the dentist. It's like, I don't know, if something fell off or started bleeding, you'd go to the doctor, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
You'd hope so. Susie, we always wrap up in the same way. We always ask our guests the same two questions. So the first question we have for you is, if you could be the fly on a wall with somebody in a certain situation, when would that be and who would be there?
Right. I would like to... I'm obsessed by polar exploration. Not doing it, obviously. It's cold. It's dangerous. No one wants to do any of that. Thank you very much. Frostbite. No, just no. But I would... I would love to be in the hut with Captain Scott at the beginning of the expedition, obviously not when everything went pear-shaped, but just to see how they were laying everything out and how they were deciding who was going to which bits and how they had their maps drawn out and how long they thought it would all take. I'd love to have known how that all happened. Then it did go a bit wrong, didn't it? But that it wasn't really their fault, was it? They were stymied by the bad weather. And that was that.
Which is an interesting thing you'd like to know, given somebody who has to plan such huge events with so many components, isn't it? You know, to get to that ultimate planning experience would be quite interesting.
Was that Captain Oates? Was he on the Scott?
Yes, that was Captain Oates. And it was so cold. I mean, I've read lots of books about it, but it was so cold that people's teeth shattered. That's how cold it was.
Wow.
I mean, that's cold, isn't it?
My goodness.
The teeth shattered. The teeth shattering man actually came back. There's quite a few of them came back. Captain Oates obviously didn't, and Captain Scott, but quite a few of them came back. And Mr. Shattered Teeth Man came back, yeah. You can't imagine being somewhere where it is cold enough to shatter your teeth, can you?
No, you can't. No.
It's impossible to comprehend. Yeah. And no amount of, even if you were there nowadays, no amount of proper clothing and anything is going to stop that much cold.
No.
Lastly, Susie, if you were given the opportunity to meet somebody, who would you like to sit down with one of your lovely glasses of white wine with for an hour?
Keith Richards. Has to be. He's my absolute hero. I mean, look at him.
Oh, Rolling Stones, Keith Richards.
He can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned.
I think he's done a lot of wrong, to be honest, Susan.
Yes, he has, but look, he's very well deserved. He's done all that stuff he shouldn't have done, and he's still with us, isn't he? He's still touring.
I think very well preserved is a good phrase for him.
Yeah, you see? It's very well
pickled.
He is. He's marvellous. He may be pickled
from the inside out.
He's lived a life. I bet he's got some stories.
Oh, can you imagine?
He probably can't remember.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Don't.
Yeah, I think
he'd be up for a drink, don't you?
Yeah, I think have Jack Sparrow from Pirates of the Caribbean based on you as a real life character, you know you've done something right.
That's very true. Yeah,
they are amazing, and they're still performing and touring. The Rolling Stones,
they
aren't they?
Are still performing and touring. Yes, we haven't seen them for a while. We have seen them a few times, but not recently because it's super expensive for a start, isn't it?
Ridiculously expensive.
Yes, yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Oh yeah, live events.
I don't want to go unless I'm somewhere really sort of close to the front. So, you know, Gaynor, who helps me with events, so she went to see Harry Styles at Wembley in a box. Right. So her friend Anna, who works for a company called Grown Alchemist, who do beautiful beauty products, she's just started there. So this was some corporate thing. And she said it was incredible, but it does spoil you for,
future
she was next,
events.
Next to David Beckham and his lovely little daughter. So she said when she was walking back, she was trying to accidentally, is this not my box? Oh, I'm sorry.
They wouldn't let her in. Watching Glastonbury at the weekend, it was this weekend gone, and watching the field with the pyramid stage, if you're one of the 250,000 people at the back of the field as Elton John was performing, I'm sure it would sound great, but you wouldn't see much.
You'd probably watch it on your iPlayer, wouldn't you? It'd probably be better.
I know, because when they did the aerial shots, I couldn't believe how many people were
massive,
packed in there.
It was absolutely
astonishing. It just shows you. I've seen bits of it, but I've been told that I have to way to say that Reese can watch it as well, because he really wants to see Cat Stevens as well, because he likes Cat Stevens.
Excellent. Very good.
Well, Susie, it's been an absolute joy.
A blast.
The time has flown. It's been so much fun.
As
so
always,
much fun.
Always.
And I think people are going to really enjoy understanding kind of the kind of you as a person, but also what's gone into building the BACD.
What's gone into building everything.
Which is
that's
amazing.
Brilliant. Really good. Really good.
It's wonderful. Right. Well, we shall leave you to it. Thank you very much for your time. We'll see you at an event very soon. If not at Congress, but definitely before then, if we can piece something together, which would be nice.
That would be lovely.
Lovely. Look after yourself, Susie. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.